Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
When I met Dilla in his basement, he put his hand out to say what's up, and I went like that. I said, show me where you got still shining.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 174, a talk with Robert Glasper. Robert is a pianist and producer who has straddled the worlds of jazz, R&B, and hip-hop his entire career. On the hip-hop side, he has toured and recorded with the likes of Q-Tip, Kanye West, Mos Def, Talib Kweli, Snoop Dogg, Kendrick Lamar, Lupe Fiasco, and countless others. He has also been a key collaborator with his college buddy, the singer Bilal, and has won several R&B Grammys. But he first earned his musical stripes as a jazz player, releasing albums on the iconic label Blue Note Records. But no matter what genre he's playing in or what band he's working with, Glasper brings his unique style, knowledge, and passion to anything he's working on. His most recent album with the Robert Glasper Experiment is Art Science. We talked to Robert at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should listen to our interview with another world-class musician who has played with all your favorite rappers, drummer Robert Sput Seawright, on episode 155. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. If you're hearing this on the day this episode comes out, October 31st, there's still time to sign up before the end of the day to receive the unreleased Wu-Tang we're giving to our patrons in November. It includes one very special RZA track you won't hear anywhere else. Otherwise, become a patron by the end of November to get access to December's file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air, and in the wider world. And now, here's your favorite rapper's favorite piano player, Robert Glasper. I'm very glad to bring to The Cipher a very special guest. I've been looking forward to him for a long time, Ladius Young.
Glad to have him here. awesome. I haven't heard that in a long time, actually. My alias name.
Yeah, so you used that on hip-hop gigs, right, back in the day?
I used to because I had, I was probably playing with my trio at the Vanguard or the Blue Note, and the same night, later that night, I would have a gig with my other band doing something, but I wasn't allowed to do both, you know, under contract. If I was playing trio at the Vanguard, I wasn't supposed to play anywhere under my name.
Oh,
the
it was
next
one of those,
three,
like,
three, 4 months. Yeah.
Things.
That's how it always is. So with me. And so I used to have a thing called Ladius Young.
Wow.
So,
did that name come from anywhere? Or?
I always call my friends Young Lad.
Oh, okay.
You know, so I just kind of flipped it around with the Ladius Young.
Nice. So, yeah.
Ladius Young's Big Adventure. I got to do an album or something.
Yeah. So tell me about that period of your career. That was like kind of just post college, right?
Yeah, exactly. I graduated college in 2000, I want to say 2001, 2000. Mm-hmm. And during that time when I was in college, you know, I was not there a lot, actually. I was playing a lot with this jazz guitar player, Russell Malone, mm-hmm. and with Roy Hargrove. And I was going between those two bands a lot. And then I was also music director for Bilal.
Don't notice, no letter, you just- just packed your shit and left. Girl, I deserve better. Treated you like no one else. How could you? You know I love you and I thought this love was true. Now we're through. What I'm gonna do? Gotta start a
Who is your college buddy?
Exactly. Yeah. My college buddy. So once I graduated college, Bilal's album came out and it was kind of full throttle with that. So when he wasn't doing nothing, I was on the road with the jazz stuff, you know, and I was with Bilal opening up for Common and Erica, you know, doing those all up in that neo soul movement right. kind of vibe. And so that's really where that whole thing started, you know, me like jogging between both worlds,
that,
you know.
And that was conscious, right? I mean, this is what I'm thinking. Like, people think like, oh, Black Radio, he like crossed over to a, you know, R&B audience, pop audience. But this was like the culmination of like a years long.
Exactly.
I don't know if plan is the right word.
Yeah. Well, actually, when I got signed to Blue Note in 2005, Eli Wolf, the A&R at the time, was like, you know, we could do the, we didn't call it the Black Radio then, but he was like, we could do the crossover now. But we both decided, let's wait. And wait for the right time. Because I wanted to first do trio albums just to solidify myself in the jazz world mm-hmm. as a jazz piano player. So you can't say shit when I decide to cross over.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because the best crossovers are the cats that had the respect first in the jazz world.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's across the board, you know? That's just how it's been.
Yeah.
If you have respect in the jazz world, then you crossed over, they respected your crossover more.
Right. And the whole crossover thing, it's been done badly a lot, right? You have people who play
mostly
jazz and they're
the
like, oh, I put some hip-hop drums on it.
So bad. Yeah, it's so bad. And that's the thing. That's what I pride myself on. And I feel like that's what makes my band one of the best bands to really ever cross over. We're all products of growing up in church, growing up playing R&B music, you know, and then moving to New York and playing with, you know, the best hip hop cats. I grew up, when I first got to New York, I was playing with the Roots. You know, I met the Roots through Bilal. And I was playing with the Roots all the time. And I was going to Q-Tip's house and, you know, running tracks with him and doing stuff with him. And then I became Mos Def's music director. And, you know, so I was really, I met Jay Dilla. I got a chance to jam with Jay Dilla every day at his house, him on the MP,
right.
me on the keys, you know. So I was getting it firsthand of what this feels like and what this is. And at the same time, I'm on the road with, you know, Christian McBride and, you know, Roy Hargrove. And so I was straddling both fields, but I'm so educated in both. That's what makes, and my whole band is like that. They're all educated in so many different styles. That's what makes the crossoverness so authentic. You know what I mean? That was Dilla Sirens.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about him because, you know, obviously you've talked a lot about working with him on Reminisce on the Bilal tune.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he, you know, would pull out records, you know, wouldn't even, you know.
It wasn't even like, let me try this record. It was right. like he knew the record would work.
Right. And the crazy thing is, and you've talked about this before, that the bass line on Reminisce.
Yo, just when I think that I forgot you. I hear that dub that we used to rock to.
Three
different records, yeah.
Different albums, too. And he knew what four or five bass line, or four or five notes from each record he wanted. He literally would, me and Bilal never forget it, because we had just came from the strip club. It was late at night. We came because he would make beats during the day, and then we would ride around his car. He would listen to his beats in his car, and then we would go to a regular club, and he'd give the DJ some shit he made that day, you know? And then we would go back to the house or go to another club. Blah, blah, blah. So we got in late at like 3 or 4 in the morning. And he was like, hey, Bilal, could you sing over this? Those four notes. And then put those four notes and those three notes. If I put those together. And we're both looking like, what? He was like, hold on. And then he put the beat together. It's like, oh, my God.
Years ago, in the midst of hallways and sliding doors. Missing links are very, very obscure. Vision of you shine.
So disgusting. I always say it's like, that's why he's a genius to me, because I watched him work. Sometimes the genius is the process.
Right.
not necessarily all the time the ending, whatever it is, but sometimes somebody's process makes them a genius because they can skip so many steps that the average person doesn't skip. You know, like Dilla, I even asked Common when Common was working on him, like, yo, Common was like, every time he picked out the record, it was the right record. He was like, it wasn't no trial and error.
And they must have seen that a lot because they were roommates for a while.
Yeah, they're roommates in LA. Yeah, he was like, it's never trial and error. It was like, yep. You know, it's like, what the hell?
Beyond that, you've said there was something about his beats and his sense of rhythm that actually changed the way musicians played, that they ended up trying to emulate the sound of a Dilla beat. What specifically do you mean?
Okay, so when you hear a Dilla beat, you realize, and it's not all Dilla beats, but for the most part, his signature is super behind the beat bass lines, super sometimes early snare, sometimes early bass drum, sometimes late snare, early bass drum, late bass drum, hi-hats real sloppy. It just is super unquantized because he didn't make his beats quantized, meaning like to a rhythmic graph.
Right.
You know what I mean? So he took the button off the rhythmic graph to where it would just be kind of wavered. And it just made everything not specifically like on the beat. And so, but it would be perfectly off the beat because it happened. He made sure it looped so it came back around the right way. You know what I mean? So me and Bilal used to call it drunk funk.
That must be tough for drummers, having to play like late with one limb and early with another.
Ask Amir. You ever interview Questlove? Ask Questlove about that. He's probably the first drummer to try to really do it.
Mm-hmm.
But D'Angelo was the one that turned Questlove onto it, really. But it's weird. It's messed up, which is why, you know, a lot of drummers, if you're a jazz drummer, a lot of jazz drummers, because jazz drummers tend to have more information.
Mm-hmm.
Period. Jazz musicians tend to have more information than most musicians because you have to just to play the music. Right. You got to have a lot of information. So a lot of drummers look at hip hop and be like, "Oh, that's simple." But if you're talking about like a 1980s hip hop beat or something, but I can throw a million Dilla beats at drummers, they will never be able to play it correctly. Because of that stagnant, how it is. You know, it takes a certain kind of drummer to be able to really do that. You know, and my drummer, Mark Hollenberg, who's in my band now, in my experiment band, he's one of the first also to play Dilla beats live because I got him on the Common gig to do the Like Water for Chocolate tour. He was in college with me. So Common asked me, "Hey, do you have any of your college friends that know how to play some hip hop?" You know, and I was like, my boy Mark and my boy Keon Harrell, trumpet. And so they had to actually play Like Water for Chocolate, which was the album. Like Water for Chocolate and Voodoo were the two albums that really... when people heard that, it started making them want to play in that style, which is that style of Dilla.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like Water for Chocolate, for sure. Because of you villains, I handle with care. Some niggas recognize your life, but they can't handle the glare. Fuck a move back, I pursue rap at the pace of a new jack. It's miscellaneous numbers and shoe stack Bruce. It's the questions, what? It's the questions, boy. It's the questions, what? It's the questions, come on. Questions. You know, that's what made musicians want to start playing that stuff. You know, and then seeing it live, it was like a whole different... There was no band that ever did that before that.
Yeah, that was, from what I remember, I saw Common on that tour in just a college show or something.
Right.
And it was pretty theatrical. I remember he had like the time travel motif with all the costume changes.
Yeah,
and
my
stuff.
Boy Keanu Trumpet, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember that so vividly because for some of those tours, Bilal would open up, you know, and it was awesome to see that. I used to go to the sound checks and like check out the band. It was awesome.
Mm-hmm. So you're obviously still playing with Common, as we discussed before we started, just this past, as we're recording, this past Monday, you did a show with him at the White House Library.
Yes.
The caged bird sings for freedom to ring. Black bodies being lost in the American dream. Blood of black being a pastoral scene. Slavery still alive. Check Amendment 13. Not whips and chains are subliminal. Instead of N-word, they use the word criminal.
Sweet. That was released just the other day.
Yeah, yesterday, right? Yeah, we did it Monday. It came out Tuesday.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was because I just was a part of Common's last project. I guess it comes out in a few weeks.
Right.
It's called A Little Chicago Boy.
The name of Common's upcoming album to be released on November 4th is Black America Again. Little Chicago Boy is one of the tracks on it.
And Kareem Riggins is the sole producer on the album, and I co-produced a few tracks with Kareem on the album, and then I played on pretty much everything on the album.
And you and Kareem are both in this band that did the White House performance.
Yes, me and Kareem are both in that band, and along with Derek Hodge on bass.
Right.
Derek's a longtime collaborator with Common, too, and Keon Harrell on trumpet, and a good friend, Elena Pinderhughes, on flute. So it was such an awesome thing to do, man.
What was that like, just kind of setting up in the White House?
I know. We were all like, still like, well, we can't believe we're here doing this. Like, and we didn't have to wear a suit. Awesome. You know?
Cause I noticed it was dressed down. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, that would be so awesome. Because the night before, I was like, are we doing suits or not? Because I had my suit pressed just in case.
Right.
And I was like, it would be so grimy and so dope if we could do it with no suits.
Yeah.
In the oval, in the office, like in the library.
Yeah.
And they were like, no suits. I was like, yeah. You know, that it just made a bigger statement. It was like real hip hop. You can't be in all suits and play some hip hop shit.
Yeah. No, Bilal was rocking the leather jacket, which is
great.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. It's weird. It was dope.
There was a moment in that show that I kind of wanted to talk about and get into like band dynamics a little bit, which is you guys actually did a live fade out.
The day women took over.
Oh, yeah, you know, I love that.
Which is incredibly difficult to pull off and make sound convincing.
Totally. That's the musical. Well, that's the jazz in us, too, because we're all jazz musicians. And so when you're a jazz musician, you have so much sensibility on the instrument and technique on the instrument to be able to do what you do loud, soft, because you have the technique. That's what technique is, really, to be able to do anything you want at any given time. It's at your disposal when you want it. A lot of people think technique is fast and loud. You know what I mean? That's not technique. Technique is being able to command your instrument.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So, and I love to do live fade outs. I do that shit all the time live. You know what I mean? So it was cool. And nothing was planned. You know, a lot of them songs, we did 4 songs.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really know how we're going to end them and stuff. You know what I mean? We just kind of vibe out. You know, one of them, I threw in a Dylan song at the end. No one knew I was going to do it. I didn't know I was going to do it. The very last song, I threw in Thelonious.
Right.
It's the Thelonious Super Microphonus. You know what's this rap shit we about to own it. You know it. It's many me's trying to clone us.
It's one of the Dilla joints that he did with Common on Like Water for Chocolate and Fantastic. So I just threw that in for a few seconds at the very end, and they just caught on, you know, and played it out. It was like, you know, it was just giving a nod to Dilla, like, yo, we're in the White House doing this, you know.
That's great. I'm so glad you're able to do that. So one of the things that I didn't know about your career until I think literally maybe yesterday was that you played on Touch the Sky on the Kanye song.
I gotta testify, come up in the spot looking extra fly. For the day I die, I'ma touch the sky.
He wasn't there, right?
No, it was just Blaze.
Mm-hmm.
It was weird. Just Blaze, what was that, 2005 or something like that?
Probably
somewhere
around there, yeah.
Somehow, my manager at the time called me. It was like, hey, there's this producer guy, and he wants you to play on the song. I didn't really know who Just Blaze was myself. Mm-hmm. Kind of, but not really. You know, and somehow he got in touch with her. I don't even know how I have to ask him how he found out about me, because I wasn't, like, famous or nothing then. You know, it was 2005. I don't even know if my first album was out. It might have been out, maybe. But anyway, he called me to just come to the studio to play on the song. So I went to the studio, and it's funny, at that time I didn't even know who Lupe Fiasco was. But I knew who Kanye was, right. You know what I mean? So he just had me replay the sample because it was Curtis Mayfield.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he had me replay the sample. And the cool thing about it is, when we were doing it, there were all these sections where he would drop out everything and be like, yo, just freestyle some shit. So I was throwing in all these cool chords and doing all this extra stuff. Yeah. So in my mind, it's going to be on a song. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be crazy. And then he invited me to the record release.
Yeah.
So I went to the record release. And when the Touch of the Sky came on, I got right by the speaker. And I was like, oh, shit. And none of that shit was in there. None of my extra stuff was in there. He kept it so straight. But he actually just let it out, I think, this year on his podcast.
Oh, wow.
He, like, played all my extra stuff I did.
Me and Questlove found a young dude by the name of Robert Glasper. Had him come to Baseline. He put some keys down. Now homies winning Grammys left and right. Salute. Enjoy. This is just another Just Blaze Takeover Beats One exclusive. Abstract Radio, what up? Rob, let's go.
It was hilarious, yeah.
So, you know, listening to your stuff on some of the trio things and things like that, you can sometimes hear you, if the mic is set up right, I guess, you know, singing along with your solos.
Oh, right.
You know, and sort of a part of that is breathing mm-hmm. in between phrases as if you're a horn player or something. Right. Can you talk about a little bit for people who aren't piano players why you do that? Like, obviously, yeah. Piano is not a wind instrument. You don't technically need to breathe between phrases.
You don't need to breathe between phrases, but the problem with piano players is that they breathe between the phrases. You're supposed to breathe through the phrase because that actually allows you to, you're more fluid and you're less tense. You know, you're less tense. When you're playing a line, like even when I was teaching students, when I had time to teach students, I would tell them to breathe out loud while they're playing a line. So I can hear them breathe. Or sometimes I put a piece of paper in front of them. He's like, now play. Let me see you. You know, let me see you breathe. And it's so hard. Some people can't play and breathe at the same time. And I'm like, you're not playing effortless if you can't breathe while you're doing something. Mm-hmm. If you can breathe while you're doing something, then what you're doing is effortless. If you have to concentrate and think about your breath, then it's not effortless. If you have to wait, then breathe. You know what I mean? Yeah. So and it comes out a different way. You know what I mean? So, yeah, you're a lot more fluid and less tense when you can breathe through your lines. The horn players have to do it the other way around.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we can do it. We can breathe while we're playing, and it just makes everything more water. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And what about the singing? Do you do that all the time?
No, I always sing, but it's not on purpose. It's not like I don't put the mic there for... Right. It's literally the mic's in the piano.
Right.
And depending on how loud I'm singing during the solo, you know? It's not like Keith Jarrett, you know what I mean? Like... Right. You know, he's a pianist that, you know, he does it. That, like, that's his, kind of his thing. And, sometimes it comes through and it's not really singing. It doesn't sound good most of the time.
Right.
It's just kind of more of a hum, like right? You know, it's kind of more of a thing like that, because I'm breathing when I'm doing it. When you're singing, you're taking a breath. I'm letting out breath. You know what I mean?
And what purpose does that serve for you? Because you must know what the line is going to sound like, whether you're singing or not.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes I'm singing along. Sometimes I'm singing my solo. So when you sing what you're playing, you play less bullshit. You know what I mean? A lot of times people let their fingers fly. Mm-hmm. And there's no lyrical or melodic content to what they're playing. You know what I mean? But if you sing it, it's harder to sing bullshit than it is to play it. You know what I mean? So I think, but a lot of piano players play, sing. Just some people are louder than others, or grunt, or something. Right. You don't even realize you're doing it until you listen back, and it's like, oh shit, that's too loud.
Right.
So, sometimes to I've had to redo takes because it was just way too loud and bad.
Yeah.
So,
oh, that must be terrible. You play something great, but it's unusable.
But it's just my humming is way too loud. And then if it's like, if I'm playing, but there's also other instruments involved, like there's a singer, then my humming can't be with the singing, you know, right. With the singer or the rapper, it could be weird. So,
You know. I want to talk about rappers for a second because obviously it's a hip hop centric show.
Because I'm an MC.
Right. You got some bars. We'll give you 16 later. but you've worked with, the best of the best, if you're going to talk about sort of critically well regarded rappers, Q-Tip and Fonte and Jean Grey and Lupe Fiasco, Pharoah Monch and all these people. Mm-hmm. What on the musical side, have you learned anything from working with rappers of that caliber?
First of all, I've learned that a lot of them are more musical than I thought, and more musical than they thought, because I can identify what they're doing and be like, you're doing this? And they'll be like, I don't know. Like, Mos Def has perfect pitch. Q-Tip has perfect pitch. They didn't know that. Tip kind of knew, but most really didn't know. I'm like, you're starting all your songs off by yourself in the correct key every time without me giving you any notes.
Right.
He didn't know
that wasn't normal.
No, he didn't know that was normal. Yeah. They would both do that. Tip and Mos would do that. They had no idea. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then, Mos plays drums, a little piano. Tip plays a little piano. You know what I mean? So it's interesting to see, cats, MCs, have some musicality. Like, they can actually do things like that. But, playing with each different cat, they phrase differently. And it's fun to play with that because the nicks and crannies of their rhyme. It's really like playing a different horn player. When you're playing one horn player, a different horn player, some horn players leave more space than others to where you can get in, and it can be like a conversation and mix, but still hip-hop shit, not overplaying, but you could just mix like a certain, I might throw in an extra chord because I know it's a break there because that's in their pattern, Like, for instance, me playing with Tip is I get more space now when I play with Talib. Because when you wasn't seeing me, night you did it in. That's when the stupid things it will begin. Where you at? Where you going? That's when I can't win. You think it's part of me, I'm a bully. Beating up the track with brutal honesty. The truth inside of me. Rappers hit the booth and they lie to me. I'm using the inspiration Guru provided me. I'm redefining the space. Because Talib has a lot to say. he doesn't really give you much space, what I'm saying? But Tim's like, I'm like, I know how to ride that, you know. And Mos the same way, you know what I mean? And certain MCs actually think musical when they're rhyming. Even if they're freestyling, they know, because they're musical, they know I have a band behind me and I know what this band can, I know the caliber of the band, I know what they could do, so they use that to their advantage and use it in their rhymes or in their freestyling, or So that's one of the reasons why I love Mos so much, mm-hmm. Because he gets it. He gets all the stuff we're doing behind him, so he leaves us that space, and it's more of a conversation, so it's really dope.
And, that leads me into talking about To Pimp a Butterfly, mm-hmm. which was a, very recent example of that kind of thing. You've compared Kendrick to, horn player. Mm-hmm. So specifically, you know, with To Pimp a Butterfly, you've said that all of it, with the exception of the very, very end that's over the Tupac interview, was all one day.
One night.
What was that atmosphere like?
It was, well, see, the first, I was in L.A. recording my album Covered. I had a trio record, Covered.
Right.
And I did two nights at Capitol Records Studios, live in the studio. So I had couches and a bar. Like, it was like, I made it like a club.
Right, there's an audience on that record.
Yeah, there's an audience there. So the second night I was recording, right before, pretty much, right, maybe during the day, my boy Terrace Martin called me. He was like, yo, I'm going to be in the studio with Kendrick later tonight. Can you come after your session? You know, I want you to lay a song. Lay a joint this song. It was supposed to be one song. It was supposed to be for free.
This dick ain't free. You looking at me like it ain't a receipt, like I never made ends meet, eating your leftovers and raw meat. This dick ain't free. Living in captivity, raised my cap salary, celery, telling me green is all I need. Evidently, all I seen was spam and raw sardines. This dick ain't free. I
mean, kind of jazzy tune.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had Spud C. Wright on the show.
Oh, you did? Okay, yeah, right.
Kendrick comes in on the second take. He walks in the studio on the second take, and he's filming. He's loving what he's hearing. It's like totally different, and he's loving it. And he's like getting in on his video on his camera phone, and he asked the engineer Ali to set up a mic in the booth in the engineering room. And so next thing I know, we counting the song off, da 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 da, da, and his voice is coming in my earphones with the famous line.
This dick ain't free.
So when I got there, they had already, the drums and the bass and everything had already been laid. Mm-hmm. They just took off the original piano player who was on. Like, Rob, you in town? Hey, listen, we need this certain vibe. And the piano player we had didn't really work out that could give us that specific vibe we wanted.
Yeah.
So after my recording session, I got in the car and I went to the studio. And we're at Dr. Dre's studio. I listened to the joint like once or twice. And then Terrace is like, just do McCoy or Kenny Kirkland, you know. And I was like, all right, cool. So they put the track on. I might have did it once or twice, and that was it. And Kendrick was there. He was like, oh, snap. He never seen me play in person. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was warming up, just playing stuff. And he was kind of like, oh, shit, you know, boom, boom, boom. So when I finished that, he just kept pulling up songs. He just kept saying, like, yo, pull up so-and-so, pull up so-and-so. What you hear on this? And he wouldn't tell me what to play. He would just pull it up, have me listen, and then be like, you hear anything? Play what you hear. And I would just play what I heard.
Wow.
And then he would pull up the next one. I will listen, learn it, and Thundercat was there too, so some of the songs Thundercat wrote.
I got a bone up here. I don't want you monkey mouth motherfucker sitting in my throne again.
Steven Thundercat Bruner is a bassist best known for his work with the producer Flying Lotus, though he's also worked with Suicidal Tendencies, Erykah Badu, Mac Miller, Childish Gambino, Bilal, and many others. Thundercat played a huge part on To Pimp a Butterfly. He played bass, produced, wrote, and even did some backing vocals on the album.
So he would come in and show me the changes or something like that. And then I would just play what I hear. And the cool thing about that is when we got to Complexions, I listened to it. And I would do everything in one take. I did everything in one take. Maybe once was two takes. For the most part, everything he played after for free was one take. I would just hear it and just do my thing. And then he would be like, cool. But if Complexions came up.
Dark is the midnight hour, her bright is the morning sun. Give a fuck about your complexion. I know what the German's done. Sneak. Sneaking through the back window, I'm a good field nigga. I made a flower for you out of cotton just to chill with you. You know I
kept playing past the cutoff, and I just kind of kept playing and kind of just changing the notes a little bit and stayed in the vibe. And I kept doing it for like another 4 minutes, you know, because I was just in the vibe. And in my mind, a lot of times when I do that, a lot of times I'm like, yo, you can do something else with this.
Right, it'll maybe be another song or
make
whatever.
Make an interlude, anything you want.
Yeah.
As soon as I got the booth, he was like, oh my God. He's like, Kendrick was like, I'm going to put some other drums on it. I'm going to put an 808. I'm going to come in. I'm going to rap with a different voice. But then he ended up calling Rhapsody and putting her on that.
When did you stop? Love and die. Color your skin, color your eyes. That's the real blues, baby.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it became a space for Rhapsody to jump on, which was so awesome. So he did exactly what he said he was going to do. Some other drums came up, you know,
yeah.
and the whole vibe changed. They threw Rhapsody on there, and it just became a dope vibe, you know.
Yeah. And so with that album, like, you know, you're there, you're playing a bunch of piano, and then you go home. However many months later, you hear the finished product.
Right.
What was that like? How different was it from what you heard at the time?
Because I did it, and I forgot everything I played. I did that one night. And then never heard it again.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he dropped the album. And he dropped that album earlier than he was supposed to.
Right, right.
First, he dropped Blacker the Berry.
Right.
And he dropped that song. And the internet was going crazy. And Twitter was going crazy. It was like, that's Robert Glasper on that track. And I was like, oh, shit, let me check the track out. And I listened to the track. And I was like, I don't hear me on there. But then the interlude right after the track is me. Right after the track, he put this interlude on there that we did at another session that was not for Kendrick. Oh, it was for Kendrick, actually. He wasn't there. But we did another session with Terrace mm-hmm. for Kendrick just to come up with some stuff. But I didn't know they were putting it on that. It just it was random as hell. But it was dope
yeah.
at the same time. You know what I mean? So that happened, and I was like, oh, snap. And then, like, a little while after that, he dropped the record. And it was so funny. I totally forgot what I played on. Mm-hmm. And then I heard the album. I was like, oh, my gosh, it's crazy. You know what I mean? I listened to it as soon as it came out. I listened to it, like, twice through, all the way through, you know. And then I realized, like, I didn't play a piano solo on These Walls Could Talk. But what they did, Terrace chopped me. I was warming up to play These Walls at his house. Because These Walls Could Talk, I didn't do at the studio. Mm-hmm. That's the only one I didn't do at the studio. I did These Walls Could Talk at Terrace's crib. In his home studio, on his roads, because everything else on the album, I play piano, acoustic piano, grand mm-hmm. piano. So These Walls Could Talk is roads, and I was over at Terrace's house. He was like, "Yo, I'm gonna pull up this track, play on this track, learn it, play it." And I was like, "All right," you know.
Yeah.
And I just was warming up on it, so he took my warm up and made it a solo in the middle of the song. So when I heard it, it caught me by surprise. I was like, whoa.
Right. Where'd that come from?
Where'd that come from?
You're recording?
And who knew that was going to be a single and like win best hip-hop song or something at the Grammys, you know?
These Walls won the 2016 Grammy for Best Rap Sung Collaboration.
But that's Terrace for you. He's so random.
Amazing. You mentioned electric piano, which gets into something I wanted to talk about, which is on a lot of your work, even on, you know, there's a mix of electric piano, Rhodes, whatever. Not so much organ, but like kind of electric piano, Rhodes, and acoustic piano, sometimes on the same song.
Yeah.
How do you know when to switch?
A lot of times I play them at the same exact time. Most of the time. Most of the time, if you hear piano and Rhodes, I'm literally playing them at the same time. But that's how I play live, too. I play my piano on the right hand, Rhodes left hand. And I've been doing that for so long, that's kind of how I'm used to playing it. So on most of my albums, if you hear piano and Rhodes, I'm playing them at the same time. And with maybe a few exceptions, because I might have been like, you know what? I want piano on this track now, after the fact. You know, and I'll throw in piano later.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I love those. I just love those textures. And it's a lost texture. It's something you don't hear a lot these days. Mm-hmm. You don't hear Rhodes these days. You don't hear piano, acoustic piano these days anymore. Everything's so keyboard based. And if you do hear a piano, it's probably a sample.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I'm just very much steeped in that vibe, you know. And I like the way it sounds mixed with electric other stuff going on. I love the way a piano cuts in. Even when you think it's like, maybe it shouldn't be a piano, put a piano in there, it's like, oh man, you know, something else.
Yeah.
You know.
So you know, you start out, like you said, with a jazz trio, basically. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point, you go to the Experiment, you know, very different sounding group. But there was a pivot point in there, which is Double Booked, an album that was half each. What was the thinking behind that record?
That was when Laddius Young. The Laddius Young stuff started popping up then. My alias. That was a real thing. That's why I had Terrence Blanchard at the very beginning. Be like, hey, you double booked.
Yo, Robert Glass, what's up, man? This is Terrence Blanchard, man. Say, listen, you know that club that I opened up, man? You know, I got you set up, man, for Saturday with the trio. So it's all good, bro. It's all good with the trio, man. It's cool. I'm just calling to make sure. You know, because I ran into Questlove, man, and Quest was telling me that he had a gig or he saw you, that you were playing, you know, with the Experiment, man, on the same night. So you know, just hit me up, bro. Let me know what's up, man. Just get it together.
Because literally, there was a few nights in New York where I was playing at the Village Vanguard and I was playing at the Blue Note. So I was playing at the two premier jazz clubs in New York at the same time.
Wow.
But I used my alias name for the Blue Note.
Good thing they're down the street from each other.
Exactly. Right. I did a Friday night and a Saturday night at a Blue Note. Mm-hmm. And then a late night joint. But I wasn't supposed to. You know, I could have gotten some kind of trouble.
Right.
But I used my alias name for that. And then I used my regular name for the Robert Glasser Trio at the Vanguard. Mm. And so that was kind of my life at the time, being double booked. And at that same time, I was playing with Maxwell. I was Maxwell's piano player starting that year, 2009. Really? So that's the tour. I didn't go on tour for myself that year. I didn't do a double book tour. Mm. I chose to go on tour with Maxwell instead. I had to make a choice.
Right.
And I knew after the double book, I was going to do Black Radio, and that's R&B shit. And I knew it would be a better look for me to be on tour with Maxwell. Mm-hmm. He's coming back. It's going to be a huge tour. And using basically my band. He was using my Experiment band.
Yeah.
My drummer and my bass player, Derek Hodge and Chris Dave, he was using that band. So it's like, this is going to be dope and much better for my cause.
Right.
What I'm going to do, even though haters are like, well, you got to do your own shit, man. Don't be selling out, you know. I
mean, they'd play with Maxwell if they got a chance.
Yeah, you know. And Maxwell's the kind of cat, too, that he made sure everybody knew who's on stage. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just like a singer and he had cats on stage and people were left not knowing. He would call you. I had like two solos in the middle of the thing. Say, Robert Glasser on keys, make sure you get his album double booked. Blah, 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 blah. Like, he will always promote it. Mm-hmm. At the end of the show, he had all the cats come up to the front and give you the microphone. And you can say what you want. Pass it down. You know what I mean? So it was more promotion than in the R&B, in front of an R&B audience.
Right.
And that's also the real crossover, too. When I was crossing over because I was playing with Q-Tip as a hip-hop audience. I was playing with Mos Def, hip-hop audience. You know, playing with The Roots. And in front of all these people who are in hip-hop world. So when I choose to do something hip-hop, they kind of already know who I am.
Right.
So therefore, that's the crossover. But a lot of people cross over, and people don't know who the hell they are. And no one knows you're there.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So
you're just making a R&B record or country record now or whatever out of nowhere.
Now you're just making your own fans confused.
Right.
And the fans that you're trying to appease don't know you exist.
Yeah.
So it's just a horrible crossover. You know, the whole point of a crossover is like basketball. You know, you're supposed to be good at both hands.
Right.
So when you switch over, boom, that's just as equal as that hand. That's the crossover.
So we're talking, you know, I think the day after the songwriter heavily involved in the album passed, unfortunately, but you've said that Off the Wall was a model for Black radio.
We spoke to Robert the day after it was announced that songwriter, producer, and musician Rod Temperton had passed away. Temperton wrote three songs for Michael Jackson's Off the Wall, the album's title track, Rock With You, and Burn This Disco Out. He would also write three songs on Thriller, including that album's title track.
Oh, man, totally.
How did you mean?
Because Off the Wall, first of all, it's my favorite record of all time. I used to listen to it since I was like in third grade, unfold it and put it on the ground and put the record on. But that album, for me, sounds like they did it all in one day, in one room, with the same cats and the same instruments. And it was just, it felt like that was the thought of the day. You know what I mean? That was the vibe of the day. Versus a Thriller, which is super produced. Every track sounds different. Every track has different keyboard sounds. And it, you know, Off the Wall had the same instrumentation on the whole album. And it was one vibe for me. And that's what I loved about it. It sounded like one producer, one vibe. And that's what I wanted to capture with Black Radio. You know, that's why there's the sonically, there's not much that changes from track to track.
Shades of lilac, cocoa hue.
Just the vocalist changes and the song changes, but it sounds like we did that all in one day, and everybody just different vocalists just walked into the room.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so it gives a different feeling.
It's interesting you say that, because to continue the analogy a little bit, it seems like maybe Black Radio 2 was a little closer to Thriller, and that like the songs are more discreet, you know, a little more different. Like exactly. They get sort of stuff's a little higher profile.
Totally. Because I don't like to do the same album twice.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I was going to do Black Radio 2. Once I did Black Radio 2, once we won that Grammy, R&B Album of the Year for Black Radio 1, then I realized, okay, now all eyes are on us now. So now we have to make an actual R&B album. And we have to like go to radio and do all these things, you know. So I was like, okay, well, one thing we can do to make it different than Black Radio Part 1 was sonically do some other stuff and try to make it, you know, sonically sound different. So that's exactly what we did. And we made it more obviously R&B. The songs were more radio, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of vibe. That was on purpose, you know.
Do you think you were successful with what you were going for?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that also got nominated for Album of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
And R&B. We won one of them. It's the second year. Best traditional thing. With Layla Hathaway, we did the Stevie Wonder tune, Jesus Children of America.
So, oh, right. Towards the end of the record there. Yeah.
So we won the Grammy for that.
Hello, Jesus. Jesus Children.
Jesus loves you, Jesus children. Hello children, Jesus loves you of America.
So I think it was very successful because it did pretty well on the radio, you know.
Yeah.
And it's good because now, you know, you can tell from social media how successful it is.
Yeah.
By all the, you know, you can look on there and see who's talking about it and blah 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 and look at the numbers and stuff. So I think it was received very, very well.
And you have Art Science, your new record out
yes.
just last month. Also short songs. A lot of them very kind of pop,
yep.
a lot more singing than on many of your projects.
Yeah.
I'm needing, wanting to be the one to offer the greatest gift that man's ever known. I'm living day to day. Show me the way to your heart. I'm living day to day.
How is it creating pop songs as opposed to primarily instrumental songs or songs where someone else is sort of handling the vocal chores?
Right. It was interesting because, yeah, for this particular album, we didn't want to make a black radio again. Not now, anyway. So we were like, oh, well, what can we do? We were like, let's all sing our own songs, you know? Because nowadays, with the trap music and all that stuff, everybody's auto-tuning it out. And you don't have to be a singer, per se, to right. have a good song.
And you guys know? Were doing the kind of like auto-tune vocoder.
Anyway, yeah. And you know, and it worked out for us because when we started doing it, T-Pain was hot. So we always were kind of with the times, even though Casey's what he's doing is really some like Herbie shit from 70s. You know, the way he's doing it, it's not auto-tune, it's vocoder. Which is different, but to the ear, it could be the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the family or cousins. So it totally worked out like that. But yeah, so we purposely said, let's sing all of our own songs. Let's get in the studio and camp out for 2 weeks and just write an album. And it just so happened that some of the stuff just came out kind of pop. We never even said, none of us said, let's
no
make
one
a pop
like,
album.
3 minute songs, let's
Nobody
do it.
Said 3 minute song. Nobody said pop album. Nobody said anything. We just said, let's write songs. And some people came with songs that were pretty much done. Some people came with ideas and we finished the idea, you know, finished each other's ideas and everything. So it was pretty, really a collective and everybody produced, everybody wrote, you know, Casey, Benjamin and Mark Hollenberg, Derek Hodge. We all just sat there and wrote together pretty much. And it just ended up having a pop edge to it. Because what I did say was I didn't want to make another R&B album. I didn't want to make a black radio album.
Right.
So when I put that out there, we steered away from that, and it just kind of went to what it is.
Yeah. And you know, you've done recently a bunch of stuff relating to Miles Davis.
Yes.
Obviously the soundtrack to the Don Cheadle movie.
Yep.
And then the kind of remix album,
yep.
Everything Beautiful. For Everything Beautiful, you got to do a, you know, Miles Davis's dream, and our producer, I think, is maybe going to, you know, want to jump out of his chair when he hears this. You got to go back and hear Miles's master tapes, right? The session tapes.
I got to take them. They downloaded them. They put them on, they made it to where I could go in and say, you know what? Give me this to that. I want that. And they put it on the hard drive for me. So I took whatever I wanted. I have a
like took,
lot
like didn't have
of
to
the
give
multis.
It back when the
no,
session
no, no, no. I
over.
Have them. I have them.
Wow.
They're mine. So I was able to go in there and take multis. You know what I mean? And so I have multis from
producer
the stuff
looks
from the,
like he wants to
I
scream.
I mean, I got the stuff from some dope stuff from the sextet, you know, the quintet with Wayne and Herbie and all that. But then I got this On the Corner, Jack Johnson, you know, Bitches Brew, Live Evil. I got all kinds of stuff from those things. And most of the stuff I use from those eras
mm-hmm.
because it's already funky.
Right.
I don't have to do much. And I purposely made that album all produced, no live instruments. I pretty much... The only live instruments added were, I took 3 piano solos on that album.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is Miles' band. I just tweaked it and messed and fucked with it a little bit. And added like some hip-hop drums here and there, mm-hmm. you know, but a lot of stuff is just the drums that are already there manipulated a little bit. Some stuff is just so funky already.
Which is in sort of Miles' aesthetic of that era, obviously. They were making collages starting in the 60s.
Totally. Yeah. Yep, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, because they were doing that stuff. Exactly. They were, you know, messing with the tape and all that. Tim and Tito.
Looping.
Yeah, looping. Tito, yeah, they're his engineer. They were even taking stuff and looping it. And Miles is cool with that, you know. Yeah.
Miles Davis's classic 1970 album, Bitches Brew, had many tape loops, conceptualized by the album's producer, Tio Macero, and actually executed by engineer Ray Moore.
And overdubbing stuff, editing stuff, and yeah, so.
Going back and listening to the multi-tracks, to, you know, unreleased takes, to individual instruments, what, as someone who I assume had studied Miles going into that, what did you learn? What surprised you?
A lot of, well, because, you know, people know what Miles' voice sounds like, but they don't really hear him talk. You don't really get a chance to hear him talk and hear him explain things to his band and hear him knowing he wants something to sound one way, but he knows how to tell you. He knows how to bring it out of you without telling you what to do. And that's what he never really did. He never really told his cats, play this. He always said, think of it like a mountain crumbling down. You know, he always had something and then they would, in their own way, take that and then be like, oh, and then it's like, there it is. You know, he never said, you know, play pop, pop, pop on the snare and, you know, or nothing specific. He always wanted you to figure it out.
You know, instead of day to day, you know, some kind of figure like that, that goes on, some kind of pulse that goes on all the time, you know, but it doesn't sound like day to day.
Do you use that technique now as a band leader?
I think as a band leader, what I did take away from Miles is somewhat that. The dope thing about Miles is he always chose the right cats for every era of music he was in. He always chose the cats who were cutting edge and cats that he didn't really have to say much to. You know what I mean? And so I feel like with my bands, I got those guys because I don't have to say much to. I love what they're bringing to the table, and I want them to always be them and bring them to the table. So I don't tell them much. And if I do have to tell them something, it is something very sparse. Like, you know, I want a beat. It's kind of like this, kind of like that, but do you. But that's the vibe of it. And then I let it go. That's literally how I say it. I say, this is the vibe. I'll sing it or try to get on drums and play it or tell the bass. It's kind of like this vibe, but that's the vibe, but do you. Mm-hmm. And that's the best way, I feel, that to make music. You know what I mean? Other than that, you can get anybody you want, any mediocre guy, and just tell them exactly what you want. Mm-hmm. And they'll play exactly what you want. But my thing is, if you have Michael Jordan on your team, you're not going to tell him how to dribble the basketball and how to dunk. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You may give him the play as a coach. Here's the play. But be Michael. And let it go. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's how you win. Once you start telling him how to dribble and when to stick his tongue out, you know, you know, that's when it goes all downhill.
Right. And, you know, speaking of telling people what to do, you know, as I mentioned, you've worked with a ton of rappers and, you know, on your records, and you'll have rappers and they'll kind of be rapping on the theme of the song. On the Miles record, for mm-hmm. example, you know, you had Fonte on the song Violet. He uses a sample of Blue and Green,
right.
And so he's playing around with, you know, blue and green and violet and
right.
all this stuff.
Yo, blues and greens and violets, eyes get heavy with the weight of the world around the iris. It's like something insane, it's like a virus, it's like a hybrid of all your joys and your pains that you bring to the table periodically and memorize them like a scientist. For you to make it, dog, you're gonna need a line.
How much do you direct a rapper when you're bringing them in on a project? Do you give them a theme? Do you say, hey, that's not great, can you rewrite it? Like, how sort of granular do you get?
It depends, because on Violence, I don't think I told Fonte shit. Because he's such a music head, I didn't have to say shit. I already knew I didn't have to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
He knew what it was. He knew what we were doing. By the way, that Blue and Green, that's an alternate intro, alternate take intro. Nobody has that. Blue and Green has been sampled before. Right. But it's only been the original. There's only one take of Blue and Green. And then there's three false starts, and I have all the false starts. So that particular piano intro you hear is a piano intro from one of the false starts. Like some other shit. So Fonte knew the vibe already. I literally didn't have to say anything. I was like, this is, you know, for this project, and we're going to use Blue and Green. And he's like, oh, kill him. And I think he might have been like, what do you want me to rhyme about? And I was like, do you? I literally think I said that. For the most part, I kind of let everybody do themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I let everybody do them. That's why Snoop, I think he shouted out his gang on my album. Gonna slip up until we get the whole zip up, tip up, crip up, die into the sun. he shouted out like the Bloods or something on my record. You know, it's like, hey, you're gonna tell Snoop what to say. You know, I'm glad he's here. You know, let him do him. And I think because it surprises me and it makes the album real. Like, mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There may be a time where I maybe say, hey, I have this song. I want it to be a love song. Or I want it to be this. Oh, for instance, the Lupe joint. The mm-hmm. Lupe joint on Black Radio 1.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. When he came to the studio, he thought he was rhyming over a whole different beat. Because he was. I gave him one beat. And he messed with some stuff over that beat. So when he walked into the studio, a few minutes before he walked in, my boy Derek Hodge, the bass player, convinced me to do this other one. He was like, nah, what about the other joint? You have, remember? And I was like, oh, I forgot about that. He was like, that's the one where she should do something over. So when he walked into it, I was like, oh, yeah, we're changing the song now. This is kind of how the song goes. This is kind of what it's about. But you can do what you do over that. And then he's like, okay, let me hear the beat. And I let him hear what Bilal sang, the chorus. And I kind of tell him where that came from. And it's kind of empowerment. And then he sat down there and just kind of wrote a verse. You ever see the inner depths of a man's soul? Or Ninja Turtles pouring out of manholes? It's this balance between the comic and the conscious that's the challenge. Between the solitary and the conference that I examines. That I imagine once a figure will be the start of world peace and the transformation of niggas. Same thing with Common on Stand Alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's kind of obvious. But I told him, you know, Stand Alone, it's a very much empowering thing about being standing in your own truth and being okay with that. Because you are the only person like you in the whole world. And that was the whole point. And being okay with that and standing in that, you know. And that's what that's about. So then he rhymed about that. Alone in a crowded room, my mind made up like a powder room. I'm the sun, giving the clouds some room. I shine like the hour noon tune. It's to stay in step with everyday men and women, the rhythm of the realness. Still, I'm legend like Will Smith. In the presence of the fake, I am a real gift. Open it.
Hip-hop-wise, you grew up in Houston. And Houston is a very interesting place in terms of rap. We've had a bunch of Houston artists and label heads and stuff on the show.
For more insight into the Houston rap scene, check out episodes 168 with Slim Thug, 126 with Paul Wall, 104 with Scarface, 62 with Swisha House's Michael Watts, and 59 with author Lance Scott Walker.
It has almost its own ecosystem of rappers, right? Yeah. You have, you know... It's important artists and DJs and radio stations in a way that's completely unique. And sort of the whole canon of rap is different in Houston than elsewhere. How aware of that were you growing up?
Very aware of the rap. Because, well, in elementary school and junior high school, we just had Ghetto Boys. you know. Mm-hmm. When we got into high school, it became everything about DJ Screw. It was all Screw tapes. Everybody was making Screw tapes and trying to get Chopped and Screw their favorite song and, you know, blah, 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 all that. So, and trap started coming into the, I mean, trap is old. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just now being national. But trap is some Southside shit that I was hearing years ago, years and years ago. You know what I mean? So people even ask me, how come on your album, you know, because on Art Science, I sung a song, Think About You. And it has a trap kind of vibe to it. I'm thinking about you. Think about you. Think about you when I breathe. Even when I blink. Tomorrow, girl, it's going to be the same damn thing. I'm thinking about you. And it's like, you trying to be with the times? And I'm like, that's actually old. You know, and I'm from Houston. I'm like from where some of the shit originated.
Are you you South Side or North Side?
South Side.
South Side.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, you said Screw, so I figured.
Yeah. Right. No, but yeah, South Side. You know, and that's a part of my upbringing. Like Screw was like, that's what we listened to. Like, if you screw and chop up the right thing, it's woo, you know. So, but that was it for me, like that. And then, like in the 11th grade, I found Midnight Marauders. And that changed my life. Mm-hmm. And then I started dwelling into all the tribe stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I became a Dilla fan once I heard that shit. And then specifically his Busta Rhymes album. Busta Rhymes with the Woo-Ha. Got you all in check. That album, I heard that and I became such a big fan. And it was a song on there called Still Shining. It's my favorite hip-hop beat of all time. Still shining you with my ultraviolet skin cancer causing laser beam. Then cause a riot. Oh shit, I'm gonna give you more and more hot flows that's gonna help you see who got the real raw. You can watch me rap. When I met Dilla in his basement, he put his hand out to say what's up, and I went like that. I said, show me where you got Still Shining. That's literally what I did.
Before
I said,
show you said me hello. Yeah.
Before I said hello. And he graciously, we walked down in there and he pulled out the records.
Wow.
It was like, this is where it's from.
Wow.
I was like, wow. Then I really got into hip hop once I got to New York.
Right.
That's when my ring started because it was like in the middle of the very beginning of the neo soul movement, and me and Bilal was taking me down to Philly to the Black Lily sessions.
Black Lily was a legendary open mic event established in 1999 in Philadelphia by Mercedes Martinez and Tracy Moore, a.k.a. the Jazzy Fat Nasties. It occurred on Tuesday nights at a club called The Five Spot. It was created specifically to help support female artists who are often shut out of more traditional open mics. Questlove and The Roots were among the night's earliest supporters and were frequent performers. The performances grew to legendary status and spawned the careers of many greats of the neo-soul era of the early 2000s, including Jill Scott, Music Soul Child, Flowetry, India RE, and more. The night also had a satellite location in New York at the Wetlands. The final Black Lily event took place on February 15th, 2005.
So we would go there every week and get on the bus and go down to Black Lily. And so we were just in there, you know, and that's when I got to be around live hip hop. Other than that, I've never been around it live. You know what I mean? Especially never playing behind them. Because that's where I first was sitting in. Bilal would be like, yo, it's my boy Rye, play keys. And that's when Amir was like letting me sit in. And James Porter was letting me sit in. And that's how I was getting my thing off. And then Amir started calling me to play with The Roots. Mm-hmm. You know, I started doing a lot of shows with them. And that's when my life, my hip-hop shit started coming together.
Was there ever talk about you joining The Roots full-time?
Yeah, well, they asked me to do the Jimmy Fallon show with them when they first started the Jimmy Fallon show. Might have been 09. I just had Riley, my son. I couldn't do it, though, because I already agreed to do the Maxwell thing, and I had my own career, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to really be there and do that every day. You know what I mean? So, and it wasn't really what I wanted to do. But they did shout me out and say, hey, would you be interested in doing it? You know, doing that. But I was doing quite a few things with Quest would call me to do quite a few things with them.
Right. Including something with Jay, I know.
Jay-Z?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Twice with Jay-Z. We did something. We did like a tribute to Jay-Z somewhere. I forget where it was. All I know is afterwards, I got off stage and Yoko Ono ran to me and drunkenly gave me a hug and started making out with me. Sorry, is that one of the things you were talking about? Like, should we edit that out?
No, sir.
She, So random. I know. It was some kind of tribute to Jay-Z. It was a tribute to Jay-Z and like Yoko Ono and like somebody else. And so the Roots were the Jay-Z, where we were there for the Jay-Z or whatever. I think, right. Did he perform though? Was he just there? He might have just been there. Maybe I'm performing him then. But I walked off stage and Yoko Ono just, she didn't know who the hell I was, just ran over and gave me a kiss and started like kissing on my neck or something. And then somebody that was with her came and pulled her off and they're like, I'm so sorry. And I was like, was that Yoko Ono? I was like, that's kind of awesome because she was married to John Lennon.
Right.
So in some weird way, I kissed John Lennon. That's kind of awesome.
Wow. That's it. That's all. Thanks for coming. That's it.
But the time we did, I remember this one thing, though. I did play with the Roots at Radio City Music Hall. Mm. It was like a tribute to Dilla, honoring Dilla, I think. And we had all these special guests. And Jay-Z popped up unannounced. And we were on stage about to play something else. Something.
Unannounced meaning you didn't even know.
I didn't even know. I don't even think Amir knew. Because he would have prepped us before. Hey, Jay might come. We're going to do this song. Let's learn it real quick.
Right.
I don't even think he knew. All I knew was in my in-ears, the stage was dark. And we're going to come up and play something we rehearsed.
Right.
Full Radio City House. Amir gets on the mic. Hey, y'all. Yo. Jay-Z's here. Do y'all know so-and-so? We rocked the boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm.
PSA, boom, yeah.
PSA.
Yeah.
So James Poison's by me. He's like, all right, you play the organ. So I was the one like, you know. So, dude, it was pitch black. He was like, all right, Jay-Z about to walk on stage. He walks on stage, turns his back to the audience, had a hoodie on, turned his back to the audience. And we started playing boom, boom, boom. Boom, and slowly the lights came up. Nobody knew he was going to be there. And then he went like this and put the hoodie off. I don't think I've ever been in a building where the shit, with that, where the audience was like that fucking high. Like, we couldn't even hear anything because it was still so much screaming in the ear. Between that and a few Maxwell shows. Like, those were the craziest, like, crowd shit where, like, you couldn't hear anything but the audience screaming. It was crazy. And we did that joint. And it was retarded.
Unbelievable. So we brought up Houston, brought up Jay.
Yeah.
Leads me to one of the things I wanted to wind down with, which is what's the embarrassing Beyonce high school story that she wouldn't want us to know.
Embarrassing story? I don't have an embarrassing story. You know, it's funny. Beyonce never liked to sing in public in high school. Like, she would never really, like, sing in front of people, you know?
She got over that pretty quick.
She got over that really quick. I don't even think it... Yeah, I wonder what that was. It wasn't like she was just shy, you know? But I used to go over her house and stuff because she used to throw little parties. You know, and invite me to her parties and stuff. So we were cool. Like, you know, I'm just Solange. And Solange was like, you know, 7 or something. Like, you know, that's my little sister. You know right. What I mean? So I'm so proud of both of them. You know, it's like, dang, y'all are, you know, doing your thing. Solange actually came to a few of the sessions for Art Science.
Oh, wow.
Because we recorded in New Orleans. You know, and I purposely recorded in New Orleans because I didn't know anybody there. And I wanted it to be like, we're in the mountains somewhere. But I didn't want to go to the mountains, really. I just want to go somewhere where I know nobody. Because if I'm in New York, I'm in L.A., the studio becomes a hang. Mm. So I only know 2 people in New Orleans. I know Solange and I know my boy Jesse. So those are the only 2 people that really came through to hang like that. But yeah, I don't have really be any embarrassing story. I just knew that one day, because my little cousin is LaToya Luckett, you know.
Mm-hmm.
LaToya Luckett was a member of Destiny's Child from 1993 until 2000.
And so I remember them being at school one day, and then the next day, them never coming back. And we seeing them on the Super Bowl singing, and they just never came back to school after that. It was like, okay, they're going bye-bye.
Amazing. And so what's going on now? You said Common's album is coming out
Common's
shortly.
Album's
Are you
coming out.
Touring with him to support that? Or?
Not touring, but we just talked about it. We got to try to do some special shows where we can use the band, like the band from the White House.
Yeah.
Where we can use that specific band, you know what I mean? Because my tour schedule is pretty full. So we're going to try to find some spots in there where we can try to figure it out, you know what I mean, and do some shows together. I'm in the process of, me and Terrace Martin have been working with Herbie.
The Herbie mentioned here is, of course, legendary jazz pianist Herbie Hancock, who's also a sampling aficionado, and whose 1983 track Rocket was the first popular single to feature scratching with our episode 68 guest, Grand Mixer DXT. The scratch that you hear at the beginning of this note and throughout our other episodes is from that track.
Producing his next record.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been in the studio with Herbie for the last 3 months. I try to take a trip out there for a week every month and try to get in there with them. Terrence is there a lot because he lives in L.A., but we do it in Herbie's crib.
Wow.
In the basement.
How close are you to that being done?
I would probably say half.
Mm-hmm.
Halfway. And Herbie's so full of ideas and so open, you know, to so many stuff. And he was super duper inspired by Pimp a Butterfly. You know, it's so funny how all the masters of the music are always open and willing to keep learning and listening. You know what I mean? Like, we opened up for Chick Corea and Herbie, the duo piano thing in Korea. Saw Chick Corea in Korea. And they got off stage and Chick Corea came over to me and said, "Hey man, my next record's going to be so influenced by Black Radio." And I looked up.
Wow.
Because Chick, that's the first jazz tape I've ever had. Like Chick Corea, Acoustic Band Live, Patitucci and Dave Booker. That was my shit. So to hear Chick say, my work is going to be so inspired by you, by Black Radio. He flew me out. I went to his crib, ate dinner. We listened to music, played duo piano for 2 days in August. You know, he let me hear some of his stuff. And, you know, we're going to get together again. But then Herbie was like, "Man, and the Pimp a Butterfly, I listen to that all the time. It's like an opera, man. I love the blah, blah." He's like, "Can you introduce me to Terrace?" You know, I was like, yeah. I was like, yeah. So next time I was in L.A., you know, I hooked them up and we all hung out. And then he was like, "Yeah, man, I love the sound, blah, blah, blah." So he's even had Thundercat come by the crib and, you know, Terrace come by, you know, doing that thing and Soundwave. And I go in there. So he's just open to it, you know, open to the new sound. It's just beautiful to see. And it's amazing to be able to talk to Herbie, man. He's such a wealth of knowledge. And
yeah,
it's awesome.
Wow, so that's quite a lot on your plate, and you're touring for Art Science?
Yeah, I'm going to tour. We're going to go on tour after I finish these NYU courses. Mm-hmm. I'm teaching
at NYU about, yeah, Miles Davis.
About Miles Davis every Tuesday. It's like 7 classes because it's the Clive Davis School. So attached to that, they do these little like kind of 7 class master class things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be done with that in about 2 weeks. Then we're going to go on tour for about 6 weeks in Europe. And come back and do some stuff in the States. Mm-hmm. And then do a full-out state tour in the spring.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, and I know from talking to Spot that musicians of your caliber often booked half a year in advance. Totally. When's your next... how far out does your calendar go right now?
through most of next year, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty solid. Wow. Booked solid. Totally. Wow.
So much exciting stuff, and yeah, we'll have to have you back soon to talk awesome, about all man. Of it. Thank
For
you.
Sure.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you.
It's always a special treat on the show when I get to talk to musicians, people who support and accompany vocalists and create their own voices as soloists. Have a unique perspective on the world of music and what makes it tick. Robert has worked in so many styles and with so many people that I couldn't even begin to list them all. But perhaps the most astounding thing about him is that you can always hear that it's him. Whether it's on the latest Common album, from which he generously played us an unreleased song after this interview was over, or on his own projects with the Robert Glasper Trio or The Experiment. It is that, more than anything, that makes Robert Glasper unique. Join us next week when our guest will be Jerome J. Rock Harmon. Jerome has worked closely with the superstar producer Timbaland for years, producing hit songs like Drunk in Love, Suit and Tie, and Picasso Baby. We'll talk about what really goes into creating a smash hit, what it's like to work with Timbaland, And about that time, he made a hip-hop-influenced album with the singer of Soundgarden. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out with as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero. The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
And my humming can't be with the singing.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Giving a nod to Dylan.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
We had just came from the strip club. It was late at night.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Ulif Ide. Sorry if we mispronounced your name.
You're more fluid and you're less tense.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
One, two, three, fuck the police.